At Total Wine & More, find the best gifts for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for sis or a single barrel bourbon that dad will love. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21. Where can you find the best gifts at great low prices that everyone will love? At Total Wine & More, of course, with so many great bottles to choose from. Find something for everyone on your list, whether it's a Cabernet for your sis, sparkling wine for a coworker, or a single barrel bourbon for dad. And if you need any help, just ask one of their friendly guides for advice. With the lowest prices for over 30 years, you'll always find what you love and love what you find. Only at Total Wine & More. Spirits not sold in Virginia and North Carolina. Drink responsibly. B21.
It took my grandma, Papa, hitting her 90s to finally run out of things to do. Before, she'd host big Saturday lunches where there were always six more dishes than there were guests. Prawns nestled into glass noodles, their necks primed for snapping and sucking. Thick slabs of meltingly tender pork belly, half submerged in a swamp of braised mustard greens. Nests of hair-like fat choy. And if you arrived there mid-prep, none of this would make any sense. But it all came together in the end. A stack of golden fried mantou that threatened to topple into a pool of condensed milk. Soft scrambled eggs with tomatoes. Octopus and lotus root herbal soup, a mound of sticky rice dotted with mushrooms and lap cheong, and next to the rice cooker of plain white rice, a bottle of Heinz ketchup.
Welcome to My Family Recipe, presented by Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network. I'm Aarti Menon, your host. I'm also the lead editor of the original essay series on Food 52. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode and on the podcast so far as we explore some much-loved heirloom recipes and the delicious stories behind them. This is a very special episode in a whole season of special episodes. And that's because our guest today is not just an essayist, but also a dear friend and colleague. Cora Lee oversees Food 52's podcast network and has played a big role in taking the stories that are part of the column and bringing them to the airwaves. Last year, we published a piece that she wrote for the My Family Recipe column that paints a vivid and, frankly, mouth-watering portrait of her grandmother or pawpaw's weekly family feasts. It's called What Grandma's Sponge Cake Taught Me About Being Asian in America. Coral also explores her hyphenated identity as an Asian American, as well as the complicated relationship that she has with her parents. Coral, we've spent so much time talking through the minutiae of the production of this podcast. It is such a treat to have you join me. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
So your pawpaw's sponge cake is inspired by what is a fairly steady presence at most Chinese bakeries. For listeners who haven't had the pleasure of tasting this incredible dessert, can you describe the taste and smell and texture?
I think what comes to mind most immediately is almost like the texture of cotton candy, or like the act of eating cotton candy, of peeling it back layer by layer. Essentially, it's a pretty light cake. It's a sponge cake. And so it's pretty tall, leavened with egg whites, not typically like a chemical leavener. And so it's a very tall cake that you could almost feels like squish into 1-inch pieces with your hair, 1-inch stack with your hand. And because it's so light, it feels like you could eat like maybe 10 slices in one sitting. And that's especially what I love about it, because it makes you kind of linger around the table, or around family gatherings, just kind of picking at piece after piece.
And I'm one of the lucky ones who's actually had the pleasure of tasting this. I remember you bringing it along to work. Now seems like many, many moons ago, but it was probably just over a year and a half ago. And you had just tested the recipe before you published the column. And I remember thinking, I could eat 10 pieces. It was so light and pillowy, and I remember it not being greasy at all, and it had this wonderful eggy aroma, and I could have definitely eaten it all day, and I'm frankly quite sad that we're not sharing a slice as we talk about it. But moving on, in the essay, you give us this ringside view of your pawpaw's table each Saturday and the array of delicious dishes that she would prepare for you all. What was the atmosphere like during these feasts? Who was present? What sort of stories did you pick up as a kid at these gatherings? Give us a sense of the atmosphere.
My papa and her husband, Gong Gong, they actually had four kids. And each of those kids, I guess my aunties and uncles, each had, you know, like two kids each. So it's a pretty decent sized gathering. And typically all these dishes that, you know, I laid out in the essay get laid out on our dining table. And it's so full that no one actually sits down to eat at the table or in a chair. But people are typically eating standing up or on the couch or on the ground. And the dining table is just kind of like a buffet or like a place to come and get your food and fill up your plate.
Would you sort of pick at it all afternoon, or was it a set period of lunching?
Yeah, it's definitely like a pick at it. I think like the newbies would try to stuff as much as they could on one plate, and you realize like it's all about going back for more and maybe just like starting off with like my papa's herbal soup just to like kind of warm the tummy, and then moving into like the meats and the rices, and then always ending with, of course, the cake.
Yeah, because you always got to pace yourself so you leave room for the cake.
Exactly.
What were some of the stories that were shared, the conversations that were had as people sort of picked at this wonderful array of dishes and spent time together?
I wish I could have, I wish I had some like beautiful stories to share, but to be quite honest, and I think a couple or many Asian American listeners will relate, is like there wasn't really much real talk happening, honestly. It's a lot of small talk. What have you been up to since the last time we've gotten here or we've gathered here together? And especially now, like with these meals happening less and less frequently, it's really like the food to me felt like this disarming entry point to being together. Even if we have nothing really substantial to talk about or to relate over, at least we're sharing this food and can share memories. And so I think what's typically discussed is like old times, old memories, less, you know, what are you thinking about now? What are you doing right now? What are you kind of worried about right now?
A recurring theme that has come up on the show is one of sort of generational divides. And among immigrant families, these gaps can be particularly pronounced, where parents and children don't just have a generation separating them. They also often have a country of origin or a country of birth. Can you tell us a little bit about the challenges of identity that came up for you when they first started sort of coming up, and how they differed from those of your parents and your grandparents?
Yeah, I think I first realized I was Asian or Asian American and not white when I actually moved to college. I moved to Ohio for college. I actually grew up in a pretty white area, white neighborhood throughout my life. But, you know, things get thrown around like you're like not even that Asian, or like you're just like one of us. And as a kid, like you love to belong and not really stick out, or at least I did. And so I kind of took that as a compliment. But when I moved to Ohio, you know, I was mingling at parties as you do as a freshman, and I kept being asked like, oh, you know, what is your favorite sushi, or like, what's your favorite Korean dish, and tell me about like kimonos. And it was like, I guess I could, but I don't really know much more than you do. But I realized like, I really was like the one Asian person for a very large radius. And it was strange to be like confronted with my Asianness, or like what seemingly was perceived as my Asianness there. And then kind of keep that in like the back of your head. And then I was also, I took this one art history class where the adjunct professor went rogue. And instead of teaching Baroque Renaissance art, she kind of was like, you know, we're going to talk about cultural appropriation this semester. And that was the first I had heard of it. I, you know, kind of thought that colonialism and the Spanish colonists like just kind of lived and existed purely in like a history textbook in fifth grade, and had not thought about it beyond that. But then I realized like, oh shit, like this happens. This continues to happen, and the effects of it are truly lasting. And, you know, one example of this being, I started to see it happening in food. And maybe it wasn't just happening, but I started to notice it. Anyway, so I moved to New York halfway through college because I wanted to pursue art history a bit more seriously. And I think this was just when the DeKalb Market Hall opened in Brooklyn, and there was a stand serving Chinese street pancakes for $17 or something ridiculous like that. And it was like, okay, so this thing that was originally seen as this source of otherness or weirdness is now A, kind of being embraced by larger mainstream culture, but also being sold in a way that is so kind of different or decontextualized from its original intention. Mm-hmm. And that like made me really mad. And you know, maybe it should have been vindicating or I guess affirming to see that, you know, Chinese food or Chinese cuisine or Chinese culture was being cool or becoming cool. But again, like, you know, the people selling it to me at the stand were white, and like I kind of dug a little deeper, and the people behind the company were white, and so it just felt like the, you know, I wasn't entirely clear like who exactly was benefiting from this, and if this was like truly generating awareness of like Chinese and Chinese American culture, or if it was again just like a simplification of it.
Yeah, so far from affirming, really. Growing up, did you feel comfortable having conversations around some of these questions you had about identity with your parents, and how did those go, if you did?
Yeah, I just realized that's where we were going with this original question. No, so not at all. I think like, again, as many immigrant or children of immigrants can relate to, I think is like our problems seem so small in comparison to what our parents have had to go through. You know, like the stories that I heard from my parents and their parents is like, we freaking swam across an ocean and, you know, waded through dead bodies and did this just to give you all a better life. And when we came to, or when they came to America, they were like, you know, often afraid for their lives. And in school, they were like attacked and made fun of. And for me to worry or to complain that I don't feel like I belong, or that people make fun of how like my lunch smells, it feels just so, so insignificant. And so it was very difficult, and actually quite honestly has never really come up in terms of, speaking with it with my parents.
I know you write about, you know, when you talk about this in the essay, you mention how a lot of their sort of problems were that they were physically threatened when they were in school or when they, you know, were othered in whatever context that they were in at the time. And so, you know, trying to sort of bridge that gap of your sort of questions around identity and them, you know, that taking a very different, having a very different feel and look to it from your mom's sort of being physically threatened and chased. I imagine must have been very sort of difficult to bridge that gap.
Yeah. And I think like, it's just a gap we'll never bridge, quite honestly, which is, I think just like adds a little more to our disconnect and just inability to, talk, honestly.
Let's talk a little bit about Popo again. So her table comes across, at least definitely to me as a reader, as a kind of oasis, a reprieve, somewhere you could go and be yourself, a place where being Cantonese was celebrated and relished and where everyone's sort of needs were included and catered to. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
I think like it's very difficult for Asian American and Asian families in general to, I think, be verbal with how much we love each other, how much we care for each other, how much we look out for each other. And so love comes out in other ways. And I think for our family, it's through food. And especially for my grandma, it's to spoil us with food and especially like exactly what we want and how we want it.
At Popo's, around the table, you could sort of drop your guard and be yourself. And it was a place where, you know, being Cantonese was celebrated as opposed to sort of resulting in conflicting sort of these questions around identity and feeling othered.
Yeah, that's right. And I think in our world, you know, beyond Popo's table, like whether at school or at work, we're not seen as like American enough, and we're not seen really as like Chinese enough. And then here at home, or even like in whenever we visited Hong Kong, like I would never feel like I was truly Cantonese or Chinese or any in any way. But in this weird third space where we're you know, we can kind of speak this unique in-between language with each other, it does feel like we're able to, yeah, let our guard down the most.
As your grandmother got older, I imagine making this feast every week became too much, and family gatherings and family feasts had to grow and evolve and change. What do family gatherings look like now? How have they evolved since that time?
I think a few years ago, I don't think it was my grandma. She would never admit to doing this or never be the one to instigate it. But someone suggested that we started going out for meals, or that we, you know, get takeout and bring it home. And that's kind of what it looks like more so now. It's less, let's, you know, make a huge potluck, but let's just order out or order in. And also it's really hard to get everyone there on the same day together, especially when I was away in New York. I had to miss a lot of these family gatherings. And now that, you know, my cousins have like their own families, it's difficult. We're all busy now, and it's hard to prioritize being together in one place.
We just talked about this a little bit ago, but in the essay you write, and I quote, "My family, like many other immigrant families, has a hard time with love, showing it, giving it, accepting it, seeing it. But what we lack in our ability to express love, we make up for with really, really good food." Food is clearly a passion of yours, Coral. And, you know, you've cooked professionally, you've written about it, you've hosted and created a number of podcasts around it. When did you realize that the culinary world was the place for you?
So it was actually, I used to watch a lot of Food Network in high school. Mainly because the food on Food Network was so different than any food I had ever grown up with or was eating at home. My parents don't love to cook, but they're, you know, great at the utilitarian type of cooking. So it was just a lot of like Cantonese homestyle cooking. And so, you know, something like bisquick or like chicken pot pie was so foreign to me. And so when I saw, I think it was like Paula Deen or something making it on Food Network, I thought it was like the most exotic, quote unquote, exotic looking thing ever. And I wanted to make it at home. I made it. It was, of course, as you might guess, disgusting. But that kind of kindled like a new love or interest in American cuisine and culture. So I started cooking a lot at home. And then, yeah, I moved to New York, and I had a amazing dessert at this one dessert bar. And I reached out to the chef and I asked to stage, and that kind of started my my restaurant journey, I guess.
This is a broad kind of assumption, but did Popo's Table in some way plant a seed in you? You know, seeing as you did that food was really the ultimate sort of unifier.
Yeah, I think like seeing how Popo took care of everybody, you know, definitely, I guess, like set my values up in terms of like what I was looking for in a job. And, you know, maybe I wasn't cut out to cook on the line for 12 hours a day for, you know, 80 hours a week. But I think that interest in pleasing people and just making sure people have a good time or are, you know, actually, I forgot to mention, like, she rarely ate herself at these functions. You know, she would just be catering to everyone. And then at the end, she would have like, you know, a bite of a sweet potato or something like ridiculous. Like she wouldn't even eat the food she prepared, but she was so consumed with making sure everyone else was having a good time and felt cared and loved for. And I think that has been a through line, especially in my work in the hospitality industry, is just making people feel comforted or maybe feel like they have like reprieve from their real life or something hard that's going on for just a little bit. And I think like that connection or that through line in what I'm doing now is like, yes, I'm not cooking directly for people as much, but I think food or the idea of food has the capacity to distract or entertain or inspire us in other ways. And I just love being able to give that to people.
And I know for a fact you've also used food to raise funds for causes you believe in and community initiatives that you care for. So there's definitely a through line there about using food as a sort of love language to show that you care. Coral, I'd love to ask if there's anything more that you'd like to add to the conversation.
Yeah, I think it's difficult because like I don't really like have the answers, or like I don't feel like I've like arrived at a place where I feel like more certain of my identity and my, I don't know, like feel like I'm a good place with my parents or my family, quite honestly. So it's hard to like arrive at like a, you know, bow wrapped conclusion with everything.
Yeah, none of this is linear, kind of like neatly packaged storytelling. It's not meant to be. I think that's the beauty of it, to be honest. We'll be right back after a short break to talk more with Coral and hear a bit from her readers.
Hi, I'm Hannah Forden, Heritage Radio Network's program manager and a producer of this podcast. If you're loving My Family Recipe, I have a few other recommendations to offer from HRN. Everyone has a food story, and Let's Talk About Food is a podcast dedicated to sharing stories about pleasure, scarcity, overabundance, all the ways that food delights and disappoints. From our first mouthful of applesauce in front of our adoring family, to our first bite into a jalapeno pepper, and everything in between. For fans of storytelling, this is a podcast you're going to devour. For fans of chef interviews, Inside Julia's Kitchen will introduce you to the bright lights of today's food world. Enjoy rich conversations with Yotam Ottolenghi, Rodney Scott, Melissa King, and other leaders in the culinary world. HRN is an independent, member-supported, nonprofit podcast network. Listen to these podcasts wherever you're listening now, or visit heritageradionetwork.org to browse our library of 35 weekly shows and more than 15,000 archived episodes. Start exploring at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to My Family Recipe. Coral Lee's essay about her grandmother's sponge cake has not only made many mouths water, but has also hit a chord for many. Especially during this pandemic, many of us turn to good food, and good writing, and great podcasts to find community. There's a thread that connects each of the following listener comments. Let's take a listen.
My name is Claudia Tang. I first read this piece last year during the pandemic when there was a lot of Asian hate rising and a lot of violence against Asians. My comment was, thank you for sharing this story. It was very touching, and I found a real comfort in it. I'm Asian American, but very far from my family right now, and in an area that's not diverse. The rise in Asian-focused hate has me nervous, but what I find more exhausting is the casual, offhand sort of othering I hear from people who I thought were my friends and better informed. Your writing made me feel less alone. Thank you.
My name is Carol Tang, and I live in San Francisco, where I grew up. I read Coral Lee's article early last year. Her article touched me in many ways. It's so relatable. My parents are long gone, and I cherish the few stories of their lives they shared with me and my siblings. But I'm also sad that there is so little I actually know about their lives as children, as young adults. I think what is common in immigrant stories is our parents tend not to complain about their hardships, rather tell it as a lesson to be remembered.
Hi, my name is Gabriela Joglar, and I read this piece last year at the beginning of the pandemic when I really couldn't see my parents for a while. The story made my eyes water. Those small acts of love that parents have are so powerful. It's hard not to speak the same language as your mom and dad as you get older, and food really helps make those bridges. My parents do it too. They always cook extra on Sundays and hand me Tupperware containers filled with food for the rest of the week. It's their way of saying I love you.
Thank you to all our readers for sharing those. Coral, coming from an Asian family and with Asian parents, I totally understand when people talk about how many Asian parents don't really say, I love you, but it can often take the form of, did you eat? Can I cook you something? Or call me when you reach home, be safe. So that was a particularly poignant comment for me to listen to, I imagine for you to listen to as well. Your writing has clearly brought up a lot of feelings for your readers, and I expect this conversation will do the same for our listeners. What do you feel after listening to these comments?
I'm tearing up a little bit too. I think it's I don't know. It's complicated. I think it's like part of me is thinking like, why does this have to be so complicated? Why can't we just say we like love you? Like my for some context, my partner is white, and his parents are obviously white, and they're just so they can so easily express physical and verbal affection. Like the first time I met them, I got a hug, which like kind of rocked my world for I think the month after, and I like don't really remember the last time I've like shared or said I love you or received it back with my parents or hugged back. And that's, yeah, it's tough. I think like with Carol and Claudia and what Gabriella said, there's some power in hearing the similarity of experience, but it's also like my heart breaks for kind of all of us. And I wish it could be, I don't know, a little more cut and dry, I guess.
How have you and your family maintained connection through the pandemic? I know you've obviously moved across the country, so I'm not sure how that has impacted how and when and how often you are able to see family.
Mm-hmm. So I moved across the country, actually, well, what felt like across the country for college, and then to New York, which was even further away from California. And throughout it all, we kept in touch over text. I don't think we've ever spoken on the phone or done FaceTime, though I think I want to experiment with that next year just to see what it does for us. But it's been a lot of texting. And, you know, it's weird, right? Like we text so much and I still feel like we don't know each other very little. But again, it's like the ways of checking in with each other, expressing love through like pictures of food or just like what each of us are up to, like the garden my mom has started. She keeps me very updated on that. So yeah, it's primarily through text. And now that I'm back in California, we see each other maybe once every other month for an in-person shared meal.
Well, if there's something else that you'd like to share with our listeners, otherwise, I just want to say a big, huge thank you and a big, warm virtual hug to you, Coral. Thank you for joining us today. I know this is never easy. It's never easy to be so vulnerable, especially when talking about family and family connections and complicated histories.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. I think the only thing, and this is actually something Trevor, my partner, reminded me of last week, is we went to a wedding and my mom was there and we were just doing our small talk thing. And then I turned, and after she walked away, I turned to Trevor and I was like, could you believe she said that? And he was like, you just had like small talk. Like there was nothing harmful in that. And I think like realizing that you don't have to bring past baggage to every conversation, and that, you know, they're not trying to hurt you and you're not, you shouldn't really be trying to hurt them. And you're really ultimately just trying to like, I think like find connection or see each other in the moment. I'm just like trying to go into conversations like that is kind of what I'm working on right now.
Thank you for sharing that. And once again, thanks for joining us on this episode. I miss you here in New York, but I'm very thankful to have shared this time with you across the microphone. Thank you for listening to My Family Recipe. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show. And don't forget to leave a rating and a review to let us know what you think of our wonderful guests and these delicious stories. Special thanks for this episode to Coral Lee and to the listeners who shared their comments so generously. My Family Recipe is produced by Dylan Hoyer and Hannah Forden. Our Julia Child Foundation Fellow is Kelly Spivey, and our audio engineer is Matt Patterson. Coral Lee is Food 52 Podcast Network's producer. Our theme song is Vittoro by Aeronaut. This show is a collaboration between Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network. There's much more to read and listen to. Find even more stories at food52.com and heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, my name is Coral, and I produce Food 52's podcast. Now, Food 52 believes the kitchen is the heart of the home and food is the center of a well-lived life. And if food audio is as much the center of your life as it is mine, here are a couple others from our network that I think you'd like. There's Kristen McGlory's 10-year strong Genius Recipes column turned interview show, The Genius Recipe Tapes. Each week you'll leave with a new recipe or technique that will completely change the way you cook. And Counter Jam, hosted by Peter J. Kim. With the help of musicians and food friends like singer-turned-saucier Khalees, podcaster-musician Hrishikesh Hirway, and rapper Ruby Ibarra, Peter seeks a deeper understanding of cultures and the identities we construct through the dishes and songs we put on repeat. Or The Sandwich Universe, a show all about, you guessed it, iconic sandwiches. Hosts and longtime BFFs Molly Boz and Declan Bond partake in philosophical debate. I mean, why even is it called grilled cheese when it's not grilled? Take listener questions and dream up delicious versions for you to try at home tonight. You can find Food 52's podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.